Hello, I'm Michael H. Dewberry, host of Artroverted, a podcast about the art world. Each week, I speak with leaders and changemakers in the arts, from artists to museum directors and everyone in between. We discuss their experiences, the communities they serve, and why they've dedicated their lives to art. In this episode, I speak with Nancy Willis, artist, activist, and educator, who until the pandemic taught principles of design at the Culinary Institute of America in Napa Valley. In her career as an artist and chef, Nancy has sought to bridge the divide between the culinary arts and the fine arts through exhibitions, workshops, and her art practice. In our conversation, Nancy discusses her work teaching art classes to baking students, Nourish, an exhibition she curated that brought the work of culinary and art world luminaries from Grant Achatz to Richard Diebenkorn in the same gallery, and her work with the Yazidi refugee community, including a Nobel Peace Prize winner. We recorded this episode on May 28th, 2020. So without further ado, let's jump in. Hi, Nancy. Thanks so much for joining me.
Hi, Michael. It's so good to see you again. And thanks for inviting me.
Of course. Well, I mean, I love your work. And I first fell in love with your work. And then you're telling what you did. And I'm like, wow, that is so interesting. Because the intersection between the culinary arts and the fine arts is something that's also very interesting. Because a lot of people would say that culinary arts is an art form.
Yeah. Well, and that was always my thing. Let's put the arts back into the culinary arts.
And part of that comes from your background as being an artist, but you were also a chef for a number of years, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's there's sort of a lot of duality through my history. You know, my grandmother was an immigrant from Romania and she was a baker. And I as a little girl would spend, you know, it's a big deal, a big event, a big ritual, baking day, all, you know, hair nets, aprons, the garb, the vinyl tablecloth. You know, we didn't just bake one thing. We were baking a lot of things. And all those aromas are still with me. So that was one positive introduction I had to cooking. And then my parents entertained a lot. There were always parties. So I had this allure about like these social interactions and events. And then the reality of supporting myself as an undergrad art student in Cincinnati, I started working in restaurants. And then that just kept going, you know. So I worked every position, front and back of the house. And ultimately, when I moved to Napa, I started working for a catering company. First in the front of the house, you know, serving, and then sort of supervising events. And then I just would help out in the kitchen, and then ultimately started doing menial prep chef tasks. I used to tell people I know how to make a pot of coffee for the chefs. That was my biggest asset. You know,
the important things.
But it was during this time when I went back to grad school at the San Francisco Art Institute. That was like 2001. So I was, you know, I was already older and had multiple decades in the industry. But when I went to grad school, I said to my professors, I want to know what the connection is between this part of my life and my art practice. I know they're somehow connected. And I couldn't really see it. And so by the time I got out, I fully understand it. It's just one big practice. It's not compartmentalized. I feel like it's only been in the past few years where I really have developed or understand who I am and have that sense of confidence about what I do and what are the things I can and cannot do. So I realize I'm somebody who can make things happen. I can get out there and make stuff happen. So when I started at the Culinary Institute, one of the things that really got to me was that the faculty chefs had no connection to the visual arts. And I'm like, how is that possible? You know? And then going to galleries and museums and seeing artists working with food and the rituals of dining who had no connection in their history to cooking. And that really annoyed me, both things. And that's when I decided to do that curatorial project called Nourish, where it's like, okay, I need to demonstrate all these things out in my community and open up this dialogue. So yeah, that stuff feels really good. But again, it's like, it all comes back to the studio. So everything, my connection to cooking and all of that started with a way to support my studio, you know, but it's still just a vital part of it.
Yeah, it's not uncommon. I think there's a lot of artists who have worked in the restaurant industry and do work in the restaurant industry as a way to support their practice and their lives. And I'm really glad that you brought up that Nourish exhibition, because I was reading about it and there were some heavy hitters in that show that you put together. Granite Katz was involved, Richard Diebenkorn, Wayne Thiebaud, Miro, Picasso.
Yeah.
And it was pretty significant. And I'm wondering if you were able to merge and gather together the culinary audience and the art audience as well. And what was the product of that?
I don't know locally how many people from the culinary world actually saw it. I did involve 6 chefs as part of it. And you probably really understand this. The curating is a really organic experience. So I set out, you know, I spent 3 years researching other exhibits like this, and sort of, I had a really hard time honing in because it was so vast. How can I do all these things, you know, and condense it? It spanned 3 centuries. I wanted to give history. I wanted to feature both local artists and contemporary artists. And as I started going, I knew I wanted to include chefs from the area, but I didn't want photos of their food. I didn't want pictures of them. So I asked them to come to my studio and create art. So in order to do that, I did a Kickstarter because I had to fund myself to be able to do it. So a Kickstarter campaign, as you know, is a full-time job. And in the course of doing that, I also realized I had always had this idea. And because I had a few people who really were cheering me on and just telling me to keep going for it, that's when I had the idea to put in a camera in a 3 Michelin star restaurant in France, right? So I did the research, reached out to the chefs, the only female Michelin-starred chef in France in the last 50 years, and Sophie Pick. And it just so happened that her assistant was really connected to the arts when she worked in Paris for an ad agency. And she was, if it wasn't, she hadn't picked up the phone, she totally got it. She understood. She helped me. So I included that in the Kickstarter. And, you know, I was able to complete both those projects. But that was all in the process of the exhibition becoming realized, right? So I went to France. I installed a Nest Cam in her kitchen. And so on a monitor in Yountville in the museum, less than a mile away from the French Laundry, people could come in and watch the kitchen of a 3 Michelin starred restaurant in Valence, France. And because the timing was right, it was 9 hours later over there. It was during the day here. And you'd see like 15 chefs and toques with tweezers putting food on a plate. It was awesome. But at the same time, I was trying to be very respectful of this privilege I had to do this thing with the camera. So I didn't allow people to take photos of her work, you know, all that stuff. I didn't promote that as much as I probably could have, because I just really liked the idea and I didn't want to jeopardize. I felt so lucky. It wasn't really covered in all the press that we got. I didn't really see a whole lot in any of the culinary magazines or blogs, you know.
And maybe that's part of the culinary arts and the fine arts, when the two mix and when they don't. And that's been your project. I want to ask you about your professors in San Francisco and what they thought about the intersection between culinary arts and fine art, and if any of them had any experience with that when you brought that to their attention. What was their reaction?
They were awesome because they're pulled back and they're I don't know, they just, they gave me a lot of artists to look at, people, performance artists doing these interactions, ways to think about service, labor, what is the exchange. I remember it wasn't my final project, but I kind of was using the cocktail party and there's even like a theory about the cocktail party, not syndrome, but that it's about this exchange between people and hospitality, that you're giving something. You think you're giving something, but you are expecting something in return. So it becomes more of a, not a commodity, but it becomes commodified, I guess. And I'd never really thought about that, you know, the idea that a host or a hostess or anybody in hospitality, because I have so much respect for people in hospitality. I think there is a real art to it of making people feel comfortable and making people feel safe and welcome. And the idea of a cacophony of things are happening at once. And I think that's the thing I like about hosting events, or even, you know, on a larger format, a curatorial project like Nourish, where, okay, you're just going to pull all these artists together, right? And hopefully something's going to happen. You don't know exactly what's going to happen. So there's some risk, but you hope it's all going to work out great. And that people who come are going to come away with a different view, with some impression, and they're going to see things a little bit differently each time. Same as a dinner. Right. That's why we have people come over. And
I think that's something that's manifested in your work as well. That sentiment about hospitality, a lot about dining, conviviality, and the relationship between space and environment and utensils or food.
Yeah, because when I first started making those dining table things, it was really about the atmosphere. What are the things in place? I didn't want it to be about the people. Because once I felt like people were in it, then I was identifying the people. But it's like, what are the things in place? Because we all go to events and we come away with different, we could be at the same event and come away with a different idea about how it went or what we saw or the comfort level that we had, right? So one of the things that came up with the SFAI faculty was this notion of a dinner table can also be a really fraught experience for people. You know, it's not always fun. So again, like recognizing that all these people at the same table, one could, you know, a marriage could be dissolving, a new relationship could be starting, you know, there's all this potential for things to happen. And I really love that. And one of the key aspects of that is light. It doesn't just represent hope, which it does, but it can, you know, it's a spark. It depends on what the lighting in the situation is, you know, romantic, candlelight, party lights, what, you know. Just the other night I had somebody, so needless to say, I have a couple chandeliers in my tree outside my house, which they don't get turned on every night, but I do have like white bulb lights on my front railing that are on all the time. And this woman who just moved in down the street, she stopped. I was outside and she said, "I just want you to know how much seeing your lights when I come home really means to me." And, you know, that's just an ordinary thing for me. But It's a reminder how people connect with them.
And I think a lot of people connect also with food and in that relationship and that dynamic and see what the product of their work is and how that affects people.
So many chefs don't want to be in the front of the house, but they are compelled. Like they share, you know, that was the other thing I noticed. There's a lot of similarities between chefs and artists. They have the passion, they have the tenacity, they're problem solvers, they're self-critical. You know, they're already thinking about ways to improve the next thing. You know, that's just a given with anybody who cares about what they're doing. There would be a lot more world peace if there were better dinners.
Right. I totally agree. So I want to circle back to your course again.
Okay.
Principles of Design. That is geared mostly towards baking students at the CIA. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's only offered to baking and pastry students at the CIA. So the idea is the way I taught it was using the visual arts, like I said, to get those ideas across. I teach them how to draw so they can represent an ellipse, so they can show a three-tiered round cake in perspective. Same thing with a square cake. Patterning or creating a motif that gets repeated, line, you know. But for me, once I started and I realized how minimal their experience to the arts was and culture in general, I really tried to emphasize projects and things to get them connected to that part of the world. So they had to, for example, go out and look at art in person and come up with a plating design on made with paper based on that work of art. So they couldn't, as much as they wanted to, they couldn't Google an image. And I limited them to the art galleries and museums that I thought had quality work and not just, you know, sort of tourist-driven work. And I really encouraged them to go to SF MoMA. And for many of them, it was their first time there. So, you know, so that was good. It got them over the intimidation because they had to do it as an assignment. And hopefully, you know, that will translate out into their lives outside of school.
Do you see it having an impact? It's really mostly about teaching how to look.
It is. Yes, of course. And it's critical thinking skills. So all the critiques are about getting them to recognize subjective point of view. If you don't like strawberries, you're not going to like this strawberry thing. That's subjective. That has nothing to do with the reality of what somebody made, right? So subjective and objective point of view, how to see that. And that's what I'm hoping, you know, that they can see. The other thing is, and this is one of the most profound areas that I personally felt with the class, is they had to be able to write. Like that's part of it. So I had them for the past few years write a color essay where they had to connect an event or a person or a place to a color. And not just green, you know, it had to be a double hyphenated color, you know, cardinal red or whatever. And some of the papers were really deeply personal. I had more than one student write about being raped, you know. One really memorable one was she used the red Solo cup as her color. So she got a call. It wasn't while she was at our school. She was like at a community college. A friend was drunk at a party and asked her to come pick her up. And when she got there, they shoved this red Solo cup in her hand. And the next thing you know, she woke up the next morning, you know, in bed, and she had been raped. And you know, like I have these students for 11 days in a 3-week intensive. And I'm getting that from them right? So of course, I immediately met with her privately to make sure she was okay, encourage her to seek support. There are amazing student services at the CIA and wanted to make sure she had that. So then when it comes time for them to do their final project, they're creating, you know, I'm telling them to create a cake design for a three-tiered cake based on something they wouldn't normally make. You know, if you're doing your friend's wedding in a couple months, this is not that time, right? This is, you're going to create a cake out of paper that you don't even know how you would make it in real life. Think crazy, think fun. And for many of them, I suggested their color essay as a starting point. I also had this other kid who was on the autism spectrum. He was Asian, and he was a complete introvert. And his paper was about the death of his grandfather. And, you know, just sort of this remorse about not spending more time with him and stuff like that. And so both these students did their final cake projects about these things, right? He did that one. And he didn't sleep for like 3 days. He made all these tiny cranes, paper cranes that he attached, like intensely labor productive, you know? And the girl who did the solo cup, I said to her, I said, this could be really cathartic for you to do this. No way do you have to do this. I'm just throwing it out there as a way for you to think about it. I want to give you the opportunity. Nobody needs to know what it signifies. It's entirely up to you, you know? And she decided she wanted to go for it. And to me, like, that's when I love my job, right? Like, I know I reached all of them. Well, not every single student, but reaching even a few students on that level, to me, that's what it's all about. And even though I was recognized within my own administration and my peers, my colleagues were certainly, they loved it when I was on campus and they would see the art projects, you know, to me, it's like, why isn't there more of this? Why isn't there a second version of this? Why aren't the culinary students getting this? These kids have so much pressure, you know, and you keep taking away the arts.
I think it's really interesting, and it speaks to the power of art and art and healing and exactly. The intersection between those two things. But it also is part of the holistic training that is offered to these students at the school. Because in this class, I assume that you're allowing them to forego the technical aspect about creating their cakes or their other dishes, allowing them to forego flavors. That's not something they're thinking about. They're being forced to think aesthetically and introspectively.
Sort of. I mean, because what I tell them is, well, for the final, they have to come up with flavor, a flavor profile. You know, I don't need to see a recipe or anything. I just need to know that their flavor profile is going to match, is going to have some correlation. You know, they're not going to do some dark stormy night and then do like lemon lavender on the inside or something, right? There has to be a connection. But they are judged on the technical as far as the craftsmanship of their project. And if they run out of time, they're judged on that, you know, those aspects. But as far as turning into an actual cake, because what I try and tell them is there's 10 chefs here that can tell you how to make it as a cake. That's not my job, you know, and don't limit your thinking by the realities of how you can make something, right? My job is to push you further and further out of stream. So, some students are really resistant to that. Mm. You know, it's sort of the nature of the that section of the industry too. I think culinary students are a little bit looser, you know, but baking is really about precision. Mm-hmm. So That's why they want to know why and how it's going to turn out, and they want it to be perfect. And I'm like, there's no perfection.
Yeah, of course. How was the assignment of them going into a museum and selecting a work of art? Is it purely an exercise in close looking, or are there ways in which someone has seen a Picasso and then translated that into a project?
This is the premise of my class, and it's based on a pretty well-used book by Orvik. And it just breaks it down to like five elements: color, line, shape, texture, and value, and the principles of organization, which they list seven of, like, where are you using these five and to what effect? So, you know, variety, harmony, balance, movement, proportion, economy, all those things. So it's hard for them, you know, they're looking through these different lenses. That's how I teach a class. I kind of deconstruct it. So each day there's a different principle we're looking at. And then at the end, they're putting it all together. So when I have them, when I send them into the museums, first it's an emotional connection. What piece speaks to you? And then look at it. What do you see? What are the different shapes? Are there different shapes? Are there a variety of color? Or are there multiples of the same color? What is the color palette? To objectively, through a visual vocabulary, you know, deconstruct the piece. And how could you translate that into a plating design? Because a plating design is essentially the same thing. You're dealing with color, texture, value, shape, right, and line. So, and that's, you know, every project I'm showing examples of food that emphasize line, examples of art that emphasize line, stuff like that.
Why isn't it offered to students on the savory side? And do you think that it would have a different impact on the way they work? And could you speak a little bit about that? I guess that's the difference between the mission and the practice of a baker versus someone who's doing just savory food.
You know, there's a couple things. When, you know, at the crudest level, baking is decorative. We're decorating cakes. On the culinary side, you know, I think the reality is the school just has to make decisions. There's so many things that can be taught, and they have to make decisions. And I get it. That's a reality when you're setting up curriculum. But I'm an artist, and I'm always going to advocate for more art inclusion, because I think if you look at it as extraneous or as a luxury class, a extracurricular class, then you're really missing what it can deliver.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it'd be so interesting to have those two separate sessions with the two separate specialties and see what would come out of it. I mean, the final project for a savory culinary student wouldn't necessarily be a cake, right? I mean, you know, you have to, I guess, reimagine how you want them to utilize the tools and the close looking that you're training them on.
Yeah, I haven't actually thought about like what I would assign a final project to be, but that is a good point. But, you know, have you ever worked in a restaurant?
Yeah, so my first summer job, I was a sushi chef, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
It was so much fun.
So when you work in like event stuff, right, and you're handing out like 100 plates, it's like meet at 6 o'clock, right? Like that's just part of the deal. The meet goes at 6, and you know, there's these prescribed notions on the culinary side about, you know, 1/3 starch and 1/3 this and, you know, whatever. So I would dive deeper into those kinds of things. But then you have, you know, and then the opposite of that is the gastronomy approaches and Michelin restaurants that are doing incredible things with food, like Granat cats, for example, and Alinea, and Aunt Sophie Pick, and Dominique Crenn. Those are the three artists that come to mind currently that are, that I think really inhabit their places in the kitchen as an artist. You know, the line is, there's no line there. So they're really, they're all challenging these notions of what expectations there are when it comes to food and how it's presented.
So I'm also curious, and I asked you this in Houston too, is you've been teaching this course for almost a decade. And during that time, the Food Network and the predominance of baking competitions and cooking competitions and even things like Chef's Table, we've been really focused on the visual aspects and the wow factor of food and pastry. And I'm wondering how that has influenced, you know, what your students, maybe what their preconceived notions of how they should be making things or the way that things should look, and also how that's impacted your, you know, relationship with these things that you create and you teach.
So I had to start to put a disclaimer on my final project thing. No Disney princess cakes. Okay. For some reason, everybody wants to do a Disney thing.
Really?
Yeah. And occasionally, like the Mario Brothers, the gaming aspects. And I'm like, fine, you can do all that stuff. But those are already prepackaged images. I want you to come up with your own images. You know, this class is about discovering who you are as an artist and recognizing your limitations and understanding how you can get support and, you know, and having confidence to do what you do best. So, there's a lot of pressure on students. It doesn't matter. To me, it looked like a lot more pressure than when I was in school. And maybe that speaks to what kind of student I was. But that was a long time ago, you know. But the pressure seems real. And I want to try and eliminate that aspect of the expectation. And I think the other thing is recognizing that art and anything is about failure. You know, we think we're supposed to do something and then we think we fail at it. But that's a lesson in discovery, right? It's just something you learn and you move on. So as far as the food networks, they all had their favorite shows. But, you know, the only one I could relate with, because the only one I really love, of course, is the Great British Baking Show. Because to me, even the way they do that show isn't about, it's not this competition of like the chef, the ultimate chef or whatever it's called, you know, when they have like 10 minutes to make, you know, with a piece of tuna and some mayonnaise and a chocolate something, you know?
Yeah, like Top Chef or, you know, Quick Fire, whatever those, yeah.
You know, that like they... Even the environment is somewhat relaxed and it's supportive between team members. It's not a teardown. You know, each person wants to win, but they cheer the other person on. And I think that the way they give the feedback, it's kind. It's not Gordon Ramsay. I mean, they all watch those shows, but I don't know over 10 years how much it's really changed.
With the wildfires raging throughout California, I caught up with Nancy on September 10th to check in and see how she was doing. Since we spoke at the end of May, have classes at the CIA resumed?
So during COVID, it looked like I would still be teaching my class in May at the CIA. But then, you know, they had to make some changes. So they wanted to make sure their full-time faculty were
employed first. So I totally get that. The lab classes started, I believe, at the beginning of this month, or maybe it was the end of July. Just the lab classes, so in the kitchen classes. But what's disappointing to me is the school has decided to move the class that I taught into the kitchen, meaning that it's not an arts-based class anymore, that it'll be taught by chef and in the kitchen. So it'll be more directly related to cooking and not to the arts. Now, granted, any chef can pull in the arts, and hopefully they will, but it speaks to the larger problem in education in our culture anyway. You know, this was one class on our campus that had an arts-based curriculum out of all of it. And now that's not happening anymore. But I enlisted a former student of mine, and we started a Bake Like a Artist class.
Fantastic. Oh, I love it. Great. Now you can reach a larger audience.
Exactly. For the home baker. So it doesn't have the same sort of tough, rigorous rituals or projects that my class had. But we've already done, you know, a 4-week session, and it was really fun. Totally fun. And yes, you're right. Because people have always been curious about what I was teaching there. So now the home baker. So essentially we're assigning a baking assignment project with a art project, and that there's some reason why they're paired up together. It's been a lot of fun.
Oh, that's great. Well, I'll have to have the information. I can post it on the website for people to sign up for.
Yes, and you'll have
absolutely, to sign up. Absolutely. I'd love to. That's so fun. Well, it's so nice to check in with you.
Likewise. I really appreciate it.
So now we're going to move into kind of the fun, lighthearted part of the podcast. These are questions that I haven't given you. It's the lightning round. So just very quick, you know, kind of.
I love it.
So the first one is early bird or night owl.
My life is a night owl, but I'm really trying to be an early bird.
I hear you. It's a struggle. It's a constant struggle. I love when I read those articles that say it's part of your biology. Don't worry about it. You know, the 9 to 5 is, you know, against you. You don't have to subscribe to that. But, you know, we live in a world that is what it is. Coffee or tea?
Oh, coffee.
Talking or texting?
Talking.
Facebook or Instagram?
Facebook.
What's the last book you read?
The last book I read was The Last Girl by Nadia Murad. You may remember she's the Yazidi survivor of ISIS captivity and went on to win the Nobel Peace Prize. And, you know, she was part of the group of Yazidis that I worked with on my conflict zone project.
Yeah. Could you tell us more about that project?
Yes. So I would say this project is probably the closest and dearest to my heart. So, you know, I live in Napa Valley, which is this beautiful place, bucolic place, and a bit isolated. So like most people, I watch the news with seeing the reports of the bombings, the destruction in Mosul and Syria as well. And it was following the captivity of these ISIS launches genocide against the Yazidis in 2014. And just the fear that those girls must have felt being held captive, raped, sold, raped again, separated from their families. They come from a farming community, and it just pained me, but I didn't know what to do. And I didn't know what I could possibly do until it was 2017. I was invited into an exhibition in Berkeley called Injustice for Some. And it was right after Trump was elected and he launched the travel ban targeting those countries. So this became a traveling exhibit. It started in LA, and it was artists created portraits of people who had immigrated to this country and done something positive. And then they were installed as if they were an American flag. They were all done 8x8. And it was a really powerful exhibit and it traveled around. So when it came to Berkeley, I was invited to participate. And I thought, this is my time. This is when I could do something about the Yazidis. But I don't know anybody. I don't know anybody in the military or any of them. So I just started researching, found they have a nonprofit organization that based in Houston. And I just called the number and talked to this guy on the phone who turned out to be the president and co-founder of the organization. And so to make a long story short, it was like the doors opened and I just could run through them. Now I had a direct connection to somebody who lived the experience. It wasn't a marketing person or a spokesperson. It was somebody who actually lived the experience. So I ended up doing a portrait of him and his family. And then I thought, I have to bring him to California to talk because we need to know. So this, while he was here, I did that. He spoke in my studio and he spoke at the gallery. And while he was here, I said, I want to apply for a grant and come to Houston because there were like 25 families of Yazidis living in Houston. And I would like to do a collaborative art project about your experience. So he supported me in the grant. I got the grant and I did exactly that. I went to Houston and I used the University of Houston printing department and they were amazing. And we just shuttled through groups of kids. First it was boys, then it was young girls and women, and then a group of men. And they created monotypes about their daily life. So I told them in the beginning, you can do something about your life in the United States, something that you miss, or you can do something about the conflict and the genocide. I didn't want to impose some sort of outcome for them. And it was awesome because they were laughing. They were so joyful. They were scared at first to do it. And we had so much fun. And it really taught me a lot about people who have suffered so much and how they can still have this hope and this joy. I'm looking around at Americans that are extremely privileged, complaining all the time, apathetic. And, you know, that was just one aspect of the project. But the main thing was they did it. It was great. And I brought the work back and exhibited it in my studio, applied for another round of funding. And so now I'm in the process, which I got, to start creating paintings of their region around Mount Sinjar in northern Iraq to give some physical geographical context to the small, intimate monotypes that they made. So I've exhibited the work locally, but I was just on the verge of getting even larger grants and really wanting to make it a bigger thing. The work was shown in LA in an exhibition. I've had minor things, but all of that came to a screeching halt with COVID. So, you know, without funding, I can't work on this project. But at the same time, we were starting this plan to actually go into the camps in Greece or even in Kurdistan before COVID. So, you know, I was super excited. In fact, that's when I met you was at the startup fair in Houston. You know, I was not only exhibiting my own work, but we got a room where Haider Elias, the president of Yazda, was there the whole weekend to talk to people in Houston about it. And we showed the monotypes there. To me, that is the best part of being an artist. Like, wow, I can do something that seems small on my end. Like, it always starts in my studio as a response, but I can have an effect that potentially be a global effect, right? And I really, really believe one person can make a difference because I've seen that with this core group of Yazidis. They really set the bar on what can be done. Now with COVID, we're one of the first people I thought of, because there's still like hundreds of thousands that are in displacement camps.
Wow.
What's going to happen when COVID goes through those camps, you know, when there isn't water and all of that? Anyway, it's an ongoing project. I haven't given up on it. It's just paused for the moment, but I'm hoping to pick it up later this year.
Well, I have faith. It sounds like it's something you're very passionate about, and the global reach that you're going to have with physically going to the camps, hopefully, and with the work. That's really exciting.
Yeah, it is. Because, again, to see the joy they had from making art, right? That it doesn't have to be this perfect thing. And that it's really about this collaboration of the process, the art making process, that they experienced that. And so for me, that was something I felt like I was able to contribute to giving them some pleasure. And with Nadia, I mean, it was a long time ago. It was before she won the Nobel Peace Prize, but I had read her book and I was so inspired. I was going to be in Europe anyway, and Haider arranged for me to meet with her in London. And she and her now husband, Abid, came to my hotel room, and we created monotypes in my hotel room in London. And it was awesome. And I see this young woman that the world is asking so much of. And she's been through so much as a young person, things I can't even imagine surviving. And I thought, for me to just watch her make a monotype and she could connect with her own creativity, that was like, I was the one I felt, though, that really benefited from all of it. I mean, it was amazing for me.
Fantastic. I feel like now you can add art therapist too, right after activist in your CV.
Well, I kept saying, you know, telling everybody, I am not an art therapist. You know, I'm not trying to interpret. I just know, I mean, to be honest, the baseline, I had the confidence to do this because of what I did with the chefs. It really wasn't about the product. It was more about this kind of exchange that happens that's very intimate when you're making art. You know, it feels really good. That's why I knew I could do it. And of course, I had no idea how open and welcoming. They're just amazingly hospitable people. And so it was great, really great. So I'm really glad you asked me about it.
That's the power of art and the beauty of making art. I wish I had time to make more art someday.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. You just got to start.
That's true. Okay, now back to the lightning round. What's your first memory in a museum?
Like, I don't even really. Well, okay. So here's one that's kind of revealing. Speaking of my life as a night owl, my undergrad, my art history class was at 8 a.m. And so for the survey of art, you can imagine.
Brutal.
If I showed up, I slept in class. Most of the time I was still at home sleeping, and I flunk art history, much to the dismay of my parents, as you can imagine, as an art major. So like 10 years, 6 years later, I'm in Florence at the Uffizi looking at Botticelli, and I'm thinking, oh, I really wished I had gone to class.
Paid attention too, yeah.
Because it's really, I've seen that before. What was the story on that thing?
Mm-hmm.
You know. And then it was actually that trip through Europe. I was traveling with an English boyfriend, and we traveled for a year across the continent.
Wow.
And seeing all the art, when I came back, I moved to San Francisco, got a studio, and started making art again after like a minor absence. So that's what really connected me, because it just stirred all this stuff up in me that I had that I wasn't really using. So that's the best I can do on that question.
What do you collect?
What do I collect? I collect hospitality things. So when I'm in France, I always go to like the antique flea markets and I collect nice linens, like linen tablecloths, linen towels, aprons, glassware, stuff like that.
If you weren't teaching and working as an artist and giving tours and working as an activist and a curator and many more things that you do, what would you be doing?
I have so many. The problem is I have so many ideas. So I think I would be, I'd be a Supreme Court judge. How's that?
Wow. I love that.
You know?
Why not?
Yeah, why not? It's like I want to make a difference. I think I can, you know, judge things fairly, see merits.
Well, maybe that's, you know, in your next life, or that'll be your next career. Oh my goodness. What's the best advice or some advice that you could give someone who wants to, you know, work in the art world, but also maybe a chef or a baker, someone who is, you know, in need of what you're, what you offer at the CIA, and maybe why and how they can get that?
Well, first of all, if you're a non-artist, I'd say take an art class. And even if you are an artist, take an art class. Take a cooking class. But the best advice I find myself giving to people is to think big and don't give up. If you really think big, go after your dreams. It just takes, be open to having people help you get there.
Ask for help.
Yeah.
If you could own one work of art in the world, any work of art, you know, if you could commission a private theft, no one would ever know you had it. What would it be?
It might be a Manet.
Luncheon on the Grass, perhaps.
No, I think it would be a still life. I just love those.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind having one as well.
I mean, he's still the artist I sort of relate to the most. But I would also love to have a Joan Mitchell.
There we go. There we go. The original iteration of this question was choose three works of art, but I think one is fine. I think it's kind of an interesting.
Well, and you know, earlier you were talking about Nourish and, you know, how I had the Diebenkorn.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a huge event when that came in, you know. And I have to say I intentionally hung my work right across from it.
Dialogue.
You know, I held my own.
I love
on the
that.
Wall,
I love that.
But it was fantastic. I mean, being an artist and walking into a gallery is very different than being a curator and walking into a gallery. And that experience of being able, it was like being able to pick your favorite paintings and say, I'll take that. I'll take that. Okay. Just deliver it. And then, okay, I'm going to hang it here. I'm going to hang it here. I mean, it was awesome.
Yeah, yeah. It's such a luxury, you know? When you're able to do that too. It is a lot of fun. I have another question about Nourish. The chefs that you invited to submit work, what kind of work did they submit?
Well, so I had each of them came one at a time to my studio and I had them make a monotype. I have a press here. Most of them had never made a monotype before. And I had them bring some images, just something about their daily rituals of what they do. So one of the chefs did a monotype of his knife collection of chef's knives from all over the world. Another chef did prosciutto because he cures meats. They did multiples. Chef Durfee, who I wanted to have somebody from the CIA. I wanted to have a range. You know, I had somebody from our local Mexican restaurant, catering company, and then so somebody from the CIA. And so he did Cocoa Pods because he's like the chocolate guy. And then I considered them as if they were an artist collective. And I called them the Chef's Art Collective. And so I mounted the monotypes on cradled panels, kind of small, various sizes, and just installed them as a grouping. So nobody had prominence over anybody else and just said, this is what this looks like, this group of chefs that are making art. And I have to say that experience of having them come to my studio, again, in the organic process, right? It was something that was revealed through the experience. We sat here one-on-one talking, you know. One of the chefs brought his daughter who was an art major. He had no connection to art, and they made art together. And that is still a lasting memory. Like, I walk in there, I can't buy my own food now,
right?
You know? I mean, it's so cool, like, to give them that experience. They would never have taken time. They did it because I asked them, and they enjoyed the process. Some of them were intimidated by the process at first. But again, it goes back to that sense of intimacy. We're just sharing stories, and I loved it. And that actually became the basis for when I went to do Conflict Zone, the process with the Yazidis, right? I had this model to work from. And so then when I came to Texas and worked with this group of Yazidis from northern Iraq, it was the same experience, right? Working with a group, I knew I could guide them through this process, and that it was this interchange between us over this process. It wasn't like we were sitting in a room just facing each other, you know, with that kind of fraught situation of dialogue. But through doing it, you know, it was really fun. So, you know, just one thing leads to the next thing. And that's also the advice I would give to somebody is you don't have to know where it's going to go. You don't have to have, you know, an end in mind. You just have to start and go and be open to things along the way.
I totally agree. Just do it. You know, a lot of people, that's the stumbling block for them, is that they focus on where it wants to go. And when it's not going that way, then they don't follow through.
Yeah, it's too much, I think, in business is outcome oriented. Even in education, what are the outcomes going to be?
Yeah.
You know, you learn so much by failure.
So my final question, there's no crystal ball, but if I give you a magic wand, what's your wish for the art world?
My wish for the art world is that artists will find funding to do the work, that our society will recognize the value of artists. School administrators and the public recognize the value of arts as vital for education and community, and that unrecognized artists will be recognized.
I totally agree with all of that. I think because of the two worlds that you operate in, I'd also like to ask you what your wish for the culinary world is.
Oh, jeez. same thing. People have access to food, good, nutritious food. You know, one of the things that I see happening now is the idea of things happening more on a local level. People are growing their own vegetables, buying local, you know, not to be graphic, but the stuff that was happening at the slaughterhouses, the mass industrialization of farming. You know, I'm hoping there can be a shift back to supporting small farms and the processing of meats, stuff like that happens on a local level as well. You know, when you asked me what else I would be doing, I said Supreme Court in my free time. I would probably, closer to reality, be involved with animals. I love animals and my connection. I feel like animals are one step above us in their connection to what's really going on in the world, in the universe. And so either in some rescue nonprofit or having a big plot of land to save the animals, that would be it.
Thank you so much, Nancy. It was so good to reconnect with you in your studio. I really enjoyed this. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Artroverted. If you like what you heard, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Be sure to tune in next week where I'm joined with Carrie Eldridge, founder of Atto Platform and Gallery, that's working with blockchain technology to secure artist royalties and bring more transparency to the art market. Remember, when it comes to art, it doesn't matter if you're introverted or extroverted, because you can always be artroverted. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you soon.